to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. This is episode 401 to be broadcast on Wednesday, June 25th, 2024 on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you are watching on Facebook Live, feel free to comment. I may or may not be able to get back to you, but I can get back to you at a later time. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment, you'd like to contribute information to the show, and you're listening right here on Facebook Live, you can comment below, or you can also send me an email at bicycletalk@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's Rant of the Week. Well, last week I talked a little bit about New York's congestion pricing, and the governor decided not to have congestion pricing. They were going to charge an extra $15 tax for driving into the city to try to reduce some of the congestion in the city because it was costing them some crazy $20 billion a year or something. I don't know, something nuts. Well, anyway, we got a little bit more to talk about there. Just a little bit more, because a federal judge has set aside a key congestion pricing lawsuit for Governor Hochul's rationale for killing congestion pricing took another blow on Thursday as the federal judge dismissed one of the major lawsuits against it. So it may be back. You never know. If you work in New York City, you definitely might have an issue there. There's still other lawsuits out there, just so you know. Folks who are teachers and public servants in New York, downtown New York City, they are very up and against this. The unions are up and against this. I understand that. There can be exclusions. It can happen. But, maybe we need to look at better transit and better ways of getting around on bicycles and e-bicycles and all that. We'll talk a lot more about that in the show, because that's what we talk about here. It's Bicycle Talk. All right, let's move on. Shout out to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah, Cambridge, Massachusetts has pro-bike policies, which have transformed it into a top city for biking. Yeah. How about that? Cambridge, local, right here, over here on the East Coast, on the very congested East Coast, where it's very, very hard to build bicycle infrastructure. But Cambridge is doing a great job. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the show. And later in the show, you know what time of year it is. It's Tour de France time. Yeah, here it comes. Quite a lineup this year. It's going to be interesting. There's some talk about, is Pogacar going to be able to pull the big double here? Is he going to be able to pull the Giro followed by the Tour de France? It's a very, very difficult thing to do. But, boy, he looked really good in the Giro, and the UAE team looked really, really good in the Tour of Switzerland. So his backup is pretty solid this year. So we'll see. You never know. There's other runners in there. We'll talk about it a little bit more in the show. Ron's mechanical minute and tip for the week. All right, so this comes from an interesting observation from yesterday's bike ride that Fran and I went on. So as we were riding, things happen, things just happen when you're out riding your bike. You just never know. I picked up a stick on the road. This is on the road. I picked up a stick. The stick went up and flipped into my rear wheel, and when it flipped into my rear wheel, no, it didn't tear the derailleur off, didn't do that, but what it did do is it caught my rear radar light, that which I had on my seat stay on the back of my bike, and it literally ripped it off the bike, and it went flying into the woods, and then we had a little bit of a difficult time trying to find it, but we eventually found it because it has a bright red light on it, and we were able to find it. Unfortunately, it broke the holder enough that I couldn't use it anymore, so I turned it off, and I put it in my back pocket along with the broken piece. And Fran and I continued our ride. It was very early into the ride, so it happened pretty early, and you know, we had to deal with it. But here's the but, and this is where the learning moment comes from. Fran had a Garmin rear light radar on the back of her bike that I had just recently put on her bike, and this was the most interesting part. My computer was already programmed to that unit because it was my old unit and I put it onto her bike. And she, of course, was just learning with this because she'd never had one of these before. So I was trying to explain to her how it all worked. And it works exceptionally well, including, and this is really interesting, if you're on a group ride and you have someone who has one of these and you don't have one, but you have a Garmin or a Wahoo computer, you can set it up so that you'll read their unit. You have to Bluetooth into it. You have to be close to the unit before you start, and then it will register on your computer. And you can get all the information that's coming off of that rear light transferred over to all the other bicycles on your ride. I was kind of blown away by this because I had no idea that this would work. I mean, it made sense because the range is, you know, it's from the back of the bike to the front of the bike, no big deal. I did not realize that the range on this unit, because my unit wasn't working, remember, okay, the range on the unit was a good 10 to 15 car bike lengths behind me. So I was still getting a reading as I rode off the front on Fran on a couple of occasions and got a little bit of space. I could look back and I could see her in my mirror, so I knew she was back there. But I'm getting the readings from her bike, okay? And I'm not right beside her. I'm not just a bike in front of her. I'm probably 10 bike lengths in front of her, and I'm still getting the reading. Powerful, really interesting. So how to make your group rides a little bit safer? If you look around in your group and you see that no one else has one of these, you could, but they all have a GPS style computer on their bike, you can have them pair into it. And then they can pair into the one unit that is on the ride, and everybody gets the same information when a car is back. So cool. So cool. Ah, the simple pleasures of life. And you know, I'm a big, big believer in the rear radar. I just think it's probably one of the best tools that's come out in years. And I talk about that a lot on this show, but there's a reason why. It makes it safer to be out riding on the road. It totally does, for so many reasons. So anyway, that was kind of a cool discovery, and I thought I would share that with you because I think it's just brilliant that this one little unit can pick up for so many other bicycles. Very, very cool. Anyway, let's move on from that and go into talk a little bit about city speed limits here. There's a few things. First of all, you know, we've got this there's a lot of cities that are studying a lot of different things about, you know, how do we improve our environmental impact? How do we improve our infrastructure? There's so much talk about infrastructure. And so there's a lot of things going on that are hopefully making it's safer for cyclists and pedestrians when they're in the city. And, you know, because of the fact that we've had an awful lot of pedestrian fatalities and cyclist fatalities over the last year or two, this is becoming a big subject. So I want to talk a little bit about this today because there is one common thing that can be done that would resolve a lot of these issues. And no, I'm not talking about shrinking the size of the gigantic SUVs, although in a perfect world, that would be great, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be great? Get rid of these big things that everyone's transporting themselves around in. I just find them obscene and absurd. But anyway, that's what we have. That's our culture right now. Americans like driving big vehicles. Not a big fan. I'm a bigger fan of small vehicles than I am big vehicles. But, you know, when everyone drives a big vehicle and you're in a small vehicle, it becomes less safe to be in a small vehicle. So, therefore, yeah. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. And of course, we as cyclists are small vehicles. And so we have to be concerned about these gigantic behemoth things that are traveling down the road that are having difficulty getting around us because they're 3 or 4 inches wider than they used to be. And so now they fill in a little bit more of the lane that you're in. And, you know, and people don't know how to drive them. Well, I'll add to that. People do not know how to drive these things. So it's really irritating, and it has increased the number of impacts that happen with cyclists and pedestrians. There's also a visibility issue on these things, and that's another thing. Well, how do we make a change without making a huge change in the automobile industry? Because that's not going to happen overnight, right? These vehicles are not going to get smaller. They're going to get bigger, and they're going to get heavier. And the reason they're going to get heavier is because as we wean ourselves off of gasoline, we are going to go over to electric power. As we go over to electric power, we are going to add more weight into the vehicle because the vehicle now is carrying a very heavy battery. So the vehicle just got heavier. That's a problem. On the technological side of that, because I now own one of these vehicles, it's not a big one, it's a smaller one, but I now own one of these vehicles, I can tell you that the braking system and the pedestrian alert system and the lane correction systems that are built into these newer vehicles are brilliant, and they really do work well. But again, we still have a visibility issue. We still have a large vehicle issue, and that is still something that we are not going to be able to resolve right away, not the way that we're going right now. So here's the way you do it. 3 reasons why cities should lower speed limits. Lower speed limit. At some point, we have to realize that anybody fighting against lower speed limits in cities is either willfully ignorant or they're a selfish you-know-what who values their convenience more than other people's safeties. And I'll let you fill in the you-know-what. But I'm sure you've used that word before. So, here it is, lowering speeds. So why am I going to talk about lowering speeds? Because there's a bunch of things you need to know. Government research shows that 20 mile per hour speed zones reduce the incidence of traffic accidents by 60% and cut child and pedestrian accidents by 67%, while overall vehicle speeds fell by an average of 9.3 miles per hour, there was no evidence that accidents increased on surrounding roads. So, 20 miles per hour saves time and improves traffic flow. Okay, we're going to look into that. Let's see what this says here. Make sure I get this right. 20 mile per hour one. Here we go. I think I kicked it out. Here we go. All right, so I did a whole bunch of research on this because I was just curious as to, you know, what can we do to inform people that this is the right way to go. You know, I've been pushing for 20 mile per hour speed limits for a long time, and if I were king, not that anyone is a king these days, but there are some who wish they were, but that's beside the point. If I were king, I would require any place that has a crosswalk, I'm talking, you know, once you move into funny signs I've seen, thickly populated or thickly settled area or some place where there's going to be a pedestrian walking across the street and there's going to be a crosswalk there in order to make it, quote unquote, safe for them, which is not safe because it's just toilet paper. It's just paint on the surface. And most drivers of motorized vehicles don't pay any attention to things like that until they're forced to. And then hopefully they will pay attention to them when they are forced to. But that's another story. So people wrongfully assume that 20 mile per hour limits delay journeys. Yet average speeds are generally well below 20 mile per hour due to congestion and traffic just in general. And traffic flows more freely at 20 miles per hour than it does at 30 miles per hour. Drivers make better use of road space by packing in a little bit closer, right? You're following a little closer because you're not going as fast. You don't have to give that little extra space, not that people do. And drivers' better use of road space makes everything work more efficiently at a higher capacity, and it's easier to merge because drivers feel safer. Some leave their cars at home, further reducing congestion. 20 mile per hour limits mean quicker journeys. The other thing, of course, is that as you are riding in, if you are riding a bicycle in a situation that has 20 mile per hour speeds, there are oftentimes, depending on your level of fitness, that you can go as fast as the car can go. So therefore, you get to travel in that lane of traffic without hindering anybody else because you can keep up to the car in front of you and the car behind you isn't going to overtake you because you're going the speed limit. This is a beautiful thing. This is why traffic circles, which some people hate, roundabouts, because they require a level of intelligence to drive through them. they sometimes make people angry, but they also lower the speed to an acceptable mile per hour, which makes the road safer. In general, it's the better way to go. We are so impatient in this country. We are just really, really impatient. That's what it really comes down to. We have a level of impatience which is not very, it's not a good scene. That's all I can say. So if we take optimal speeds for maximum urban traffic flow and run them at 20 miles per hour, and this here's why it's more efficient than 30 miles per hour. All right, doesn't seem like a lot, right? 30 miles per hour, 20 miles per hour. Drivers cut their speed braking distance. Okay, that's a big one. Shorter gaps mean more vehicles can use the available road space, reducing standing traffic. Filtering at junctions becomes easier too. It's far easier for motorists to pull into traffic traveling at 20 miles per hour than at 30 miles per hour. So junctions work more efficiently and queues reduce. So that means like a stop sign or a stop light where there maybe is a right-hand turn on red, or maybe it's a traffic circle where everybody's just flowing through and everything's moving nicely. It just makes it easier to merge in, and merging becomes movement. Merging is good. Merging is positive movement forward. Motor traffic volumes decrease since slower speeds encourage active and sustainable and shared travel. Walking and cycling levels rose up to 12% after a decrease in one city's 20 mile per hour limit. That's a big deal. 12%, that's a lot. So let's see, what else did I have in here, which was kind of cool. So buses operate more efficiently. The reduced length of queues means that bus journey times decrease and become more reliable. Buses now become a more attractive alternative to a car. Smoother driving and less wasteful braking and acceleration cut fuel use by 12% in Germany after a 30 kilometer per hour, 18.6 miles per hour limit was implemented. Air quality also improves since moving traffic emits less pollution than standing still with engines on. Department of Transport's speed flow plots are in the COBA, that's Cost Benefit Analysis Manual, of the Design Manual for Roads and Bridges. This computer program shows that urban traffic flow improves at lower speeds. Other traffic models support this analysis. A highly experienced professional mathematician has modeled a system that progressively reduces the limit the closer you get to the city center. By linking traffic lights in sequence along main routes into the city, it's possible to time the lights so motorists who are traveling at the prevailing speed limit benefit from a green wave of traffic lights. They can also get to the city center smoothly without an endless cycle of starting and stopping and queuing. So, this is all good stuff, right? I mean, lower the speed. Simple, 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 simple. Everything gets safer. Being hit at 20 miles per hour as a pedestrian or a cyclist is truly a bad experience, but it's not usually a deadly experience. And add 10 miles per hour onto that, and it changes dramatically, dramatically. So, you know, this is a good thing to cut down the speeds. There's also, this is interesting, if you are decreasing your speed, you're opening up your peripheral vision more. As you increase speed, your peripheral vision closes more, so you see less going on to your sides as you're going faster, because your focus is more, hopefully, directly in front of you and not on your cell phone. So these are all things that make a difference. Like, I've got more. So it just, the time one gets from boosting speeds in urban areas can end up being a surprisingly modest. In downtown streets, the difference between a 25 mile per hour commute and a 45 mile per hour commute is roughly an additional 48 seconds for every 3/4 mile traveled. That turns out to be in 10 miles, we're talking about 10 mile commute, which is on the average what Americans drive to get to work or to get home, and it's actually 5 to 10 miles, and we're talking about 6 minutes. So can you leave 6 minutes earlier to get to work in the morning? Sure you can. That's not that hard, right? Can you afford to get home 6 minutes later because you slowed down? And when you got home, you're actually able to hug your family because you're still alive, because you didn't get in a horrible accident? Sure you can. It's really, this is common sense. Common sense. So there it is. 48 seconds for every 3/4 mile traveled. And that's a 20 mile per hour difference. It's 25 miles per hour to 45 miles per hour. This stuff just all makes a big, big difference. I've got more here. But right now, I just want to shout out to Cambridge, Massachusetts, because where are they? They're right here, right? Nope, that's not them. Go back here. All my sets got screwed up because I went from my downstairs computer from my upstairs computer. So we're going to go here. And this is from People for Bikes. And this title of this article was How Pro-Bike Policies Transformed Cambridge, Massachusetts into a Top City for Cycling. All right. So it shows here very, very nice protected barriered lane here, which is super. We want to see more and more of this. It just makes a huge difference. Lots of people on bicycles within that lane, which shows them being protected by the concrete barriers that are on the sides. These barriers don't have to be very big either. We're really talking curbing with enough of a gap on them so that you can, you know, plant flowers in them and make them. It all looks very, very nice. It's a very, very nice way to do it. And it just gives enough of a visible barrier as well as a physical barrier to keep cars out of that lane. So, and you don't need it all the time. You just need it to break up occasionally. Like, so you're going to open it up at intersections, but you're going to close it up when you're on free-flowing traffic areas. So it can be gapped, and yet it still gives a great visual, and it really, really teaches people how to drive their cars and trucks, which is part of the problem here. We have an education process. I had an encounter a number of years ago with a gentleman driving a large pickup truck, of course. It's always a pickup truck, isn't it? So anyway, he was driving a large pickup truck and we had an altercation. He got a little too close to me and I, you know, hit him with my hand because, you know, I just slapped the side of the bed of the pickup truck because he was about to hit me. And I prefer to make a statement than become squished. So he pulled over. He was angry. He was angry that I touched his vehicle. That's understandable. I touched your vehicle. Yep, I get it. I get it. But I immediately thanked him for pulling over and talking to me about what just happened. And I asked him if he understood what just happened. And he said, well, you touched my truck. You shouldn't do that. You know, he's like yelling at me for touching. I said, no, wait a minute. If I could touch your truck, how close were you to me that I would be able to reach out and do that? And I immediately extended my arm all the way out. And as I extended my arm all the way out, I said, from that fingertip to this shoulder is 3 feet. That is the law in this state of how much distance you need to stay away from me. And that is a law, and it is a $100 fine should you ever get caught doing that. Of course, we know that's not enforced. We know that that's a huge part of the problem, is the only time it's enforced is if the cyclist is actually hit. And then it's still not always enforced because a lot of the officers that come to the scene of the accident do not know the law. Isn't that nice? I had that happen with a friend of mine. And he was hit, and nowhere on the infraction of the police report was there a show that the driver was charged with $100 for hitting the person. And that's the first offense in the state of Connecticut. Second offense is $250. The third offense is $500. So if you get caught doing it repeatedly, it gets more and more expensive. But it's not enforced. So if it's not enforced, then we got a problem. Or if it's only enforced when you hit someone, then you have to hit three people before you get the $500 fine. It goes beyond ridiculous. But anyway, There are some. Cambridge, Massachusetts is one of the 2024 cities on the rise, scoring a tremendous 72 out of a possible 100 in this year's ratings. This year, they ranked number 2 out of 604 medium-sized U.S. cities for bicycling. In 2019, the Cambridge City Council passed the Cycling Safe Ordinance, CSO, one of the strongest complete street ordinances in the nation, requiring the city to construct separated bike lanes when streets are reconstructed. Since then, bike infrastructure has popped up all across the city. Thanks in large part to their quick build projects to create separated bike lanes without major time or funding investment of other infrastructure improvements. But Cambridge's commitment to better bicycling started well before the CSO. The backbone of the work really started back in the early 90s when the Vehicle Trip Reduction Ordinance was created. And that's from Kara Selderman, who is the transportation program manager for the city of Cambridge. The ordinance was voted on by the city council and said that we're going to reduce single occupancy vehicle trips through promotion of walk, bike, or transit trips. Now, if you know anything about Cambridge, Cambridge is really, it's downtown Boston. It's in a very, very congested area. It is the home of MIT. And I think Harvard is also there. Harvard University is also in Cambridge. There's a lot of universities around. So there tends to be a lot more travel by bicycles and also by pedestrians in that area because it's the way to get around. It makes more sense. The college campuses are built within the city itself, so there are roads that travel through, and the university campuses are right there. So that means that you're going to see more cycling and you're going to see more pedestrian activity there. So this is a great place to do something like this. College campuses are always the best place to start because you have a high influx of pedestrian and bicycle activity. So Selderman said, a slew of other city projects also work towards the same goal. The city's climate action plan supports active transportation. The Cambridge growth policy includes provisions for walking and biking infrastructure, and even the Cambridge Public School District plan looks to help more students safely bike to school. With multiple policies supporting bicycling as a form of transportation in the city, bike infrastructure grew, and so did the number of people bicycling. The City of Cambridge's website includes an interactive map and data table showing the evolution of the city's bike network alongside bicycle counter data dating back 20 years. And that is really cool if you get a chance to look at that. If you go on to Streets Blog, streetsblog.org, you can find all this information. I love the site. They've always got great stuff. It's very progressive. It shows you lots of good stuff. But you can also go on to peopleforbikes.org, and that's another great place to get good information about bicycles and infrastructure and Vision Zeros and all the other wonderful things that are going on right now. So one major project highlighting Cambridge's dedication to better and safer bicycling is the redesign of Inman Square, named one of People for Bikes' best new bike lanes of 2023. Inman Square is an extremely complicated intersection with seven different streets coming into one area. Yeah, you ever been to Boston? It's a little confusing, I gotta say. It's an old city, one of the oldest in the country, and it was kind of built, I like to say it was built around the Boston Common, which is a green, which is very, very close to the bay and to the shore. And then everything that was built around this thing, and it got built out. So I kid about this, but people who are from Boston or the Northeast all laugh and go, oh yeah, yeah, I understand that. You can be on a road that goes north, south, east, and west and never get off of that road. Yeah, it happens. It just, everything zigzags. There's no straight lines anywhere. It is not built on a grid. You know, you go to New York City, much more grid-oriented, totally different experience. But Boston is one of those places that you just, if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to get in a lot of trouble around there. That's why riding the bicycle is so much easier around Boston than it is to drive a car. When I was on the road doing my sales route in the bicycle industry, I used to drive to Boston and I would go from bike shop to bike shop. And it would often take me far more time to drive my car 3 or 4 miles than I could have done on a bicycle. So some of my rep friends, when they would go into New York City, into Boston, they would stop at a T station. If you're a Boston person, you know what a T station is. It's one of their transit hubs where the trains go. And they would park their car at the T station and then take their bike off and then ride their bike everywhere. And they could get around the city much quicker and then go back at night and then get back in their car and drive out of the city. So it's just a much easier way to get around. But you do have to ride your bike extremely aggressively in order to be able to survive in that high traffic situation. So it's getting better. That's what all I'm saying is it's getting better. They're doing things that are definitely a whole lot better. Separating bike lanes is absolutely brilliant. Bump outs where there's pedestrian walkways so that it's well indicated to motorized vehicles when they're coming by that, oh, there's a pedestrian crosswalk there. How about that? you know, not that anybody completely understands how a pedestrian crosswalk works. I had that encounter a couple of weeks ago when I was helping with the rails to trail ride when we were crossing a road, and a gentleman in, oh yeah, you guessed it, a large pickup truck got really upset with me because I stood out in the middle of the road and stopped traffic so that 30 cyclists could cross the road in a crosswalk, which in the state of Connecticut is legally the right, that the car is legally required to stop at a crosswalk to allow pedestrians or cyclists to cross over. But this guy, obviously, he didn't read the rule book. Brings me back to the original conversation I was trying to have earlier, where I was talking to the gentleman about the rules and the one I had tapped the pickup truck, you know, and he pulled over and all. And I explained to him, you know, what the current rules were. And he said very kindly, he said, "I'm so sorry, I had no idea." And I said, "Well, how would you?" I said, "When was the last time you got a driver's license?" And he laughed at me and said, "Well, I'm 50 years old. It was a while ago." And I went, "Yeah, I understand." And I said, "The problem is that we're not required to learn once again where all the changes are and how things work, because we got our driver's license when we were 16 years old, and then we just continue to drive. Once you have it for life, and it's not a requirement to re-educate before you get it renewed." That's another pet peeve. That's another thing that I would like to see changed. If I were king once again, I would put notifications in everyone's license renewal or registration renewal, just because it would just be a simple, inexpensive piece of paper that would explain to the driver as they're re-registering their vehicle. Or even more and better than that, since everything has gone online now, if you could register your vehicle online, to have a short questionnaire of things you should answer to understand what the new rules are before you get your registration renewed or your license renewed. What a brilliant idea, right? Simple, simple, simple. The simplest things. Sorry, I'm spewing common sense here, and I'm afraid that it probably will go nowhere, but that's what it is. So anyway, Cambridge gets a big shout out. They're doing all sorts of cool stuff. They're doing safe routes to schools in Cambridge. We do that here in a lot of places. When I was on the board of directors for the Connecticut Bicycle Coalition, we had a big safe route to school program. A lot of towns took advantage of it, and we helped a lot of towns understand and realize what engineering their roads for bicycle safety was all about. So it's all good. So shout out to Cambridge. We're going to take Cambridge off the map here for a moment, and we're going to go on to what else we have here today. So this is another one of those just kind of DUH moments, but there's a critical difference between 20 and 30 miles per hour, okay? This comes from Greater Washington, okay? Washington, D.C., okay? This article came out a long time ago in 2015, and it might seem like a small thing reducing motor vehicle speeds to 10 miles per hour, but that 10 miles per hour can make an enormous difference for the safety of a street and how comfortable people feel about walking and biking there. So they have a nice visual here that shows something I spoke of short while ago about the peripheral vision. So your vision, your ability to see out to your sides. And they show it at 15 miles per hour. They show a very wide scape. You can see both sides of the street. You can see pedestrians on the sidewalks, and you can see the buildings that you're going by. And then you bring it up to 30 miles per hour. All you see is the street in front of you. You don't see any of that on the side because your focus changes. And your focus changes because your speed increases. So slowing it down is good for a couple of different things. And this is one that many city planners don't think about, but If you can lower the speed in, let's say, your downtown commercial district, people will be able to see that little cafe over on the right or that little store over on the left and become much more aware of the things that are being offered in that city that they maybe never even knew were there. So for commerce, it's a huge boost. It makes a big, big difference. I try to explain this whenever I talk to anyone in municipalities about, you know, because I'm the bike guy, you know. People call me and they say, hey, Ron, would you mind doing a talk for us and letting us know, you know, what your feelings are about this and that? And so, you know, I'll go and I'll chat with them about it. And the big thing I explain to them is, and the last time I did this is, I'm not here to solve all your problems. I'm here to offer you an opportunity to expand and make more money and make your city more productive. An opportunity. That's all it is. And you can go in one direction or you can go in the other direction. You can choose to leave everything just the way it is. But there's an enormous opportunity to increase commerce and tax revenue in your town just by changing your infrastructure, lowering your speed limits. And it's a no-brainer. It's an absolute no-brainer. And we've got to do something about this really soon because people are dying out there and that's not good. So you look at the average speed of traffic on an urban commercial street, and there's a lot of things that begin to change when you slow down from 30 to 35 mile from the 30 to 35 mile per hour range to the 20 to 25 mile per range. Most importantly, perception, reaction time, and crash outcomes are far better at 20 than at 30 miles per hour. While traffic flow doesn't seem to change very much, the perception angle is perhaps the most interesting. The one I just talked about is that your peripheral vision changes with speed. With speed, you have to be looking at where you're going all the time. With lower speeds, you have a chance to look side to side because you're not going so fast. It just makes a huge difference. That changes your reaction time when you're driving a motorized vehicle. It also changes reaction time when you're riding your bicycle too. So what does that mean? It means that if something happens in front of you and you have to make a very quick stop, you can do it because you've reacted to what's happening in front of you. So there's just so many things that you can do that make a difference as far as lowering speeds go. And I think it's really, really important. I have more information here to share on this than I have time for today because we have other things that are coming up and we will be talking about very, very soon. And so I will table these for next week because I have other things I would like to discuss on this. Let's go to the bicycle racing edition of Bicycle Talk, the Tour de France preview. Yes, yes, yes. This is exciting. As you well know, if you have listened to me before, you understand that I am a big advocate of bicycle racing. I love bicycle racing. I just love it. It's just so exciting to me, and there's so much going on right now with the Tour de France. There's we've got what's going to happen with Tadej Pogačar after winning the Giro. He's got a killer A team coming in to work with him. They say he brought the B team to the Giro, although I didn't see anybody that was really a B team level rider there. I thought it was a very hot team. But, you know, we've also got Egan Bernal coming in. We've got Mark Cavendish coming back. Yeah, Mark Cavendish is going to come back and ride his final, he says, Tour de France. Is that going to be the time when he gets to get more wins than Eddie Merckx had in the Tour de France? We don't know. We really don't know. I think not. And I think not because I think that there's other sprinters involved that are going to make a big difference on those sprint stages. And there's just some really, really hot stuff going on right now. And I think Cav, as good as he is, I just don't see him getting around some of the other Jacobsen and some of the other riders. I just don't see it, especially when Jacobsen's lead out man is Matthew Vanderpoel. How do you beat that combination? I mean, you got the guy who can pop out 1,500 watts of power that is a lead out man for the big sprinter who is probably putting out at least as much power. That's just another story. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's people talking about, you know, the Tour de France Giro d'Italia double for Tadej Pogacar. There's people talking about, nope, it's not going to happen because there's just so much going on here. We've got other big fighters in there. We've got Jonas Vingegaard, who is in great shape right now. We've got Primoz Roglic and Remco Evenepoel, Tom Pidcock. And I mean, there's going to be a big lineup this year. This is going to be an exciting Tour de France, I think. And we will see exactly how exciting it is. There's a lot to talk about here. I will be talking about it more in future episodes because there's a big change in the Tour de France this year. A, it is not starting in France. Okay, now they've done this before. They've started in Belgium. They've started, you know, just over the line and done it there. But they're starting in Italy this year, which is really interesting. They're not only starting in Italy. I've got stage one up here on my computer, and it's very interesting. And the first few stages, I think, are going to be very, very interesting. But so there is that. It also is not finishing in Paris this year for the first time in a very, very long time. And the reason it's not finishing in Paris this year is because the Olympics are happening in Paris at the same time. So you can't really have all that congestion and that, you know, giant parade coming into Paris when the Olympics are there. So they had to reroute it, and so there will be a different finishing point. And the last day stage is very short, but still guaranteed to be action-packed because it's always a sprinter stage and there's always a lot of action on the finish line at that point. But leading into that, there's a big mountain stage the day before that. I mean, it's like there's a lot of tough stuff on this year's tour. I'm very surprised and impressed. Stage one is Florence to Rimini. And so Florence, Italy, all right? And it's right in the heart of Italy. And it will, the first stage includes six categorized climbs, a very hilly finale before a flat run into Rimini, where the first yellow jersey will be attributed. So the cross-cut pattern of the profile is impressive, to say the least. I see a number of things here. Let me see if I can blow this up just a little bit so I can see with my eyes that don't work so good. I see a category 2 climb, 2 category 3 climbs, followed by a category 2, followed by another category 2, followed by a category 3, and a second category 3. And that's the roller coaster that goes on the first stage of this year's Tour de France. The next day is definitely a little bit more conservative, but the overall classification could explode. The first day certainly has potential for it, but the second day of racing, the riders climb up the Madonna di San Luca on two occasions. The climb, which is raced every year at the Giro di Emilia, is short but very steep and explosive, and create differences before descending back in the town for a finale. So there's a couple of good spikes on that one too, and those will be very, very interesting. That's just stage two. And then stage three, again, more, it's probably going to be more of a sprinter stage for sure. They'll probably have their first opportunity on stage three, but there's a couple little walls they're going to have to get over before they get there. So that will make it one of the flattest days in the race, but it is still going to have some obstructions, we'll call them, as they're coming in towards the end. So that should be interesting. Stage four, they're going to cross over the border into France through the Alps. Guess what the Alps are? Big hills, real big hills. So we got a couple of pretty serious climbs here, two category twos, and then the last climb, which is not the finish, but it brings you close to the finish with a long descent back into the finish, is a beyond category climb. And that is stage four. So fourth day in, they cross back over into France, and then all the fun begins. It's going to be a great year. It's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of excitement, a lot of things going on. The following day on stage five, they're saying it's it starts in the Alps, but it will be a day for sprinters, and as the riders are heading out of the mountains, and there should be a big sprint coming into St. Vulbas. And then Dijon, super flat, stage six, 163 kilometers. It's going to be obviously a sprinter's day on stage six. We'll get into more after that. There is a time trial on stage seven, and it is 25 kilometers. So it will be, it is not flat. It has a bit of a roll in the middle of it. So it's not exactly a flat time trial. The Tour has steered away from flat time trials, but this is one, if you could call it that. There's a small ascent and a descent halfway through. And so, like I said, there's a bump in the middle. So that will be interesting too. And it's just, there's just more and more craziness going on with this. Lots of short, steep, popping hills. Lots of crazy stuff. And stage nine is not exempt from that. So anyway, that's the Tour de France for this year. I'll resume next week on stage 10 as we talk more about what's going on. And it will... Stay tuned for more Tour de France coverage as we get closer. Remember, July is our time for that. So let's go back here and just wrap things up here a little bit. We've got the event page now, 2024 Quiet Corner Bike Tour, which is presented by the Thread City Cyclers. That's our local club right here. If you're interested in knowing more about some of the great roads that we have up here in northeastern Connecticut, it is the Quiet Corner for a reason. There aren't that many people that live in this side of the state of Connecticut. Connecticut is a very congested state until you get across the Connecticut River and over into eastern Connecticut. It gets a lot hillier over here, there's no question about that, but it's beautiful. There's lots of farmland, it's gorgeous, and we have a couple of upcoming bike tours that will show you exactly what it's all about. So if you've never been here before, please come out and join us. This is the Quiet Corner Bike Tour presented by the Thread City Cyclers. There's a 100-mile ride, 102, a 64, a 40, and a 20-mile ride, all road rides. And there's also an 18-mile gravel loop. And so that is coming up on July 28th, 2024, right as you've got all this energy in you because you've been watching the Tour de France, right? So that's good. The Other thing that is coming up on August 17th that's local here is the Steeplechase Bike Tour, and that is Saturday, August 17th. That's a 20-mile road ride, a 35-mile road ride, a 62-mile road ride, a 5-mile fundraising walk, and in addition to last year's 18-mile gravel ride, there's going to be an additional 40-mile gravel loop available, and that is a 90% dirt road and trail ride. So if, and I say this very carefully, but if you see a half a dozen cars on that ride, on that 40-mile ride, that will be a lot. That would be a lot. It's really the quietest roads out there. So you are on pavement for a little while, but the roads, the pavement that you're on, if there's one state road involved, it's a very quiet road and oddly quiet. And it's everything else is back roads and dirt roads, and it's really cool. So I'm really psyched about that. We're already getting people to sign up for it because they're getting excited about it. Other things that are coming up, Project Mayhem Cyclocross Series is coming up this fall. There's 8 races involved this year. Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross is one of those races. That is the one that I have been managing for the past 40 years, on and off for the past 40 years. So anyway, that's going on. That will be, I'll have more announcements on that in the fall. I think that my registration opens on July 1st, if I remember correctly, but I have to get that all straightened out before July 1st. Anyway, so what's your feeling on congestion pricing in New York City? Should it be there? Should it not be there? Should we penalize people for driving into the city? Should we figure out a way to take care of those public servants that can't afford to be penalized for driving into the city? Something can be worked out. I'm sure it can. And this is going to have to happen in other big cities too, because the congestion has gotten out of control. And how about lowering speed limits? What do you think of that idea? I'd love to hear your comments on that, so please let me know. And let's see, what else do I have here? Hey, the Tour de France, it's right around the corner. Yay, Tour de France. This is going to be really, really a lot of fun. I do love my listener comments, so please be sure to write in. You can comment anywhere, either leaving me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or you can also comment on my Facebook live videos too. So 2024, more miles, ride and commute to work or around town, better fitness, or simply enjoying the bicycle ride you take more by slowing down and smelling the roses. I'll say it again, it won't be my last time. You got to get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic and dangerous roads and the price of gas and lack of places to safely ride, and ride your bicycle instead. You just might surprise yourself. It's a lot of fun. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch, maybe next week. If you're watching on Facebook Live, feel free to comment, or you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, or now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. If you would like to contribute information to the show or be a guest on the show, you can send me an email, bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. Saved mine 3 years ago. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores and WHUS.org. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Get on your bikes and ride!